So that concludes our first half for this Friday word of mouth news segment. Stay tuned. Don White and Anti-Psychiatry Radio is right up next.
Welcome, friends. This is your proud anti-psychiatry radio host, Don Whites, for another special edition of anti-psychiatry radio, aired twice a month, the second and fourth for Friday, 6:30 to 7. I hope many of you are listening in, and it is the January 22nd, 2010 edition of Anti-Psychiatry Radio. This evening, this is a special and somewhat sad event that I'm airing, and it is about the death of a sister, an outstanding advocate and activist by the name of Judy Chamberlain, who died recently on January 16th of this year in Boston, or just outside of Boston. I've known Judy, although we didn't get together the last few years of her life, but she was just an awesome force in the psychiatric survivor and disability rights and human rights movement. And I just would like to read this tribute that I wrote in the last day or so for Judy. And I wish I had been in Boston. There was a celebration of her life while she was alive, while she was in, I believe, a hospice, but I understand she died among friends at home, which I believe is the best way. A tribute to Judy Chamberlain. The death of Judy Chamberlain is a huge loss to the psychiatric survivor, Mad Pride, and disability rights movement. Judy was 65 and died at home on September 16th, 2010. Together with her family, thousands of friends, activists, and survivors, and survivors are mourning her death and celebrating her life. Judy was an immensely talented and dedicated activist, a fearless and courageous advocate for the civil rights and human rights of people labeled and stigmatized, demonized as mentally ill. Her 1976 book, On Our Own, Patient-Controlled Alternatives to the Mental Health System, was and still is a movement classic. It demystifies not only mental illness. It validates the growing self-help movement, which is now worldwide, based on independence and self-empowerment, and continues to inspire thousands of psychiatric survivors and activists around the world. In her book and in public lectures, Judy spoke out against what she called sane chauvinism or mentalism. That's the common public myth and stereotype that allegedly mentally ill people, I put quotes around mentally ill people, are incompetent, incapable of making decisions for themselves, unpredictable, and violent. That's the myth bias, which unfortunately is still true to it, still widespread today. At the same time, she strongly urged survivors to take control of their own lives and organize. On Our Own, the first self-help group of psychiatric survivors in Ontario, adopted her book title as its name. Judy first came to Toronto in the early 1980s to offer valuable support to On Our Own members, and she gave immensely empowering and inspiring talk in its drop-in. And I remember even, I think, inside the notorious Clark Institute of Psychiatry, if my memory serves me, which it often doesn't. In the early 1970s, she helped start the Mental Patients Liberation Front in Boston. And she supported the establishment of Vancouver's Emotional Emergency Center for Assaulted Women Survivors and the Mental Patients Association, MPA, the first self-help group of psychiatric survivors in Canada. With several of us survivor activists, she proudly and fearlessly participated in a number of nonviolent civil disobedience actions, including the anti-shock protests in New York City, Syracuse, and Burlington, Vermont in the 1980s, and participated in demonstrations against forced drugging and Big Pharma in Boston and Philadelphia in the late 70s, 1980s. As a leader in the psychiatric survivor liberation movement, Judy was a keynote speaker and resource person during several annual conferences for human rights and against psychiatric oppression, including the 10th conference held in Toronto in May 1982. Judy was also director of education at the National Empowerment Center in Massachusetts. She helped establish the Ruby Rogers Drop-In Center in Boston, who was a consultant on survivor perspective at Boston Center of Psychiatric Rehabilitation, and was also a member of the board of directors of the National Association for Rights Protection and Advocacy, NARPA. Judy gave inspiring public lectures in Toronto in the mid-1990s and as late as 2002, and was a featured speaker in national and international conferences in several European countries. During the last 10 years of her life, Judy was particularly active in trying to unite the psychiatric survivor and disability rights movements that share several basic issues and principles, especially freedom, autonomy, people's right to make their own decisions, no matter what the disability. She authored the groundbreaking and empowering report titled From Privileges to Rights, People with Psychiatric Disabilities Speak for Themselves, for the U.S. government's National Council on Disability. For her outstanding work, Judy won several awards. 1992, she won two awards. One was the Distinguished Service Award of the President of the United States, no less. That was sponsored, or I believe, by the National Council on Disability. That same year, she won the David J. Vail National Advocacy Award, and that was apparently sponsored, I believe, or with the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. In 1995, she won the N. Neil Pike Prize for Services to People with Disabilities. And Boston University School of Law was involved, I believe, as at least an endorser or supporter of it. Judy Chamberlain spoke truth to power, particularly against psychiatric power against psychiatric imperialism. She left us a rich legacy of advocacy, resistance, and pride. Her spirit lives. Rest in peace, Judy. For those of you who want more information about Judy Che Chamberlain, here's a website you can tune in. You can get it. That's narpa.org/Chamberlain, spelled CHAMBERLIN.HTM. I'll repeat that. narpa.org/Chamberlain.HTM. Now I think we can take a break right now, Mark or Susie. Mark, my trusted friend here, a trusted tech person on the controls, that we can maybe get some music going, Mark. And I'll be back soon. You're listening to CKLN Revolutionary Radio. The Anti-Psychiatry Radio is the name of my program, 88.1 FM on your dial. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back in a few minutes. And friends, that was the Ghost Dance by Bill Miller, in honor and in memoriam, as a dedication to our late sister, outstanding activist, Judy Chamberlain. Now, I'd like to spend a little more time, just to continue since the last show, on shock machines and the continuing campaign to keep them classified as unsafe. As you might remember, friends and fellow activists, sister, brother activists, the Food and Drug Administration of the United States for the last few months has been trying to upgrade these brain-damaging, memory-destroying machines as safe in Class 2. And there is a virtually worldwide campaign to stop it, to keep the machines as long as they exist in Class 3, unsafe or high risk. Mind you, the FDA hasn't even bothered to test them for medical safety, which is this same situation in Canada. The Health Canada's Medical Devices Bureau has still refused, to my knowledge anyway, and we're double-checking, has neglected to test these very powerful machines capable of delivering 400 to 500 volts of electricity, I should add, for their medical safety. Now, a friend sent in one of the more outstanding activists, anti-shock activists in the world, and author Leonard Roy Frank in San Francisco, has kindly sent me a copy of his letter of protest. It's a damning critique of these machines and, of electroshock in general. I'd like to just read some excerpts from Leonard's January 7th letter of this year to the Food and Drug Administration. And I want to give you a couple notes after I read some excerpts. And he begins this way. This is a summary, which is quite detailed, about three pages, of his case against ECT. Now, the first paragraph sums it up quite well, I think. Electroshock is a brutal, and he writes, electroshock is a brutal, dehumanizing, memory-destroying, intelligence-lowering, brain-damaging, brainwashing, and life-threatening technique. ECT robs people of their memories, their personality, and their humanity. It reduces their capacity to lead full, meaningful lives. It crushes their spirits. Put simply, electroshock is a method for getting the brain in order to control, is a method for gutting the brain in order to control and punish people who fall or step out of line and intimidate others who are on the verge of doing so. Second point, brain damage is the most ruinous effect of ECT and lies at the root of most ECT's other harmful effects. It is also the 800-pound gorilla in the living room whose existence electroshock psychiatrists refuse to acknowledge, at least publicly. Nowhere is this more clearly illustrated than in the American Psychiatric Association's book manual, I guess, Practice of Electroconvulsive Therapy, which states that, quote, in light of the accumulated body of data dealing with structural effects of ECT, brain damage should not be included in the ECT consent form as a potential risk of treatment. Brain damage not included in the consent form. This is the case in Canada, friends, I should add, too. Frank goes on. The exclusion of brain damage as a risk of ECT makes a sham of the entire ECT-informed consent process and turns what is ostensibly a medical procedure into an act of criminal assault. The following statements and reports, all by psychiatrists or neurologists, refute the APA's position on the risk of brain damage from ECT, and I may add, refute the position paper of the Canadian Psychiatric Association, the one in 2001 or 2002, which similarly greatly minimizes, in fact, denies structural permanent brain damage from this so-called safe and effective procedure. Now, here's a, there are many quotes that Leonard has, very, very relevant and powerful quotes, and I'm just going to pick out a few in the last 10 years or so. Here's one from Peter Bregan, who is arguably the most, anyway, he is the one of the most serious critics of electroshock. And he has been on record since his 1997 book of advocating a total ban. Peter Bregan is in the States in New York and is a psychiatrist. Quote, after a few Bregan writes in 1998, there is an extensive animal research literature confirming brain damage from ECT. The damage is demonstrated in many large animal studies, human autopsy studies, brainwave studies, and an occasional CAT scan study. Animal and human autopsy studies show that ECT routinely causes widespread pinpoint hemorrhages and scattered cell death. While the damage can be found throughout the brain, it is often worst in the region beneath the electrodes. Since at least one electrode always lies over the frontal lobe, it is no exaggeration to call ECT an electrical lobotomy. Close quote. And if you want to read the whole article where Peter Bregan made that statement, you can get it in the title of the journal article is Electroshock, Scientific, Ethical, and Political Issues, published in the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine, Volume 11, pages 5 to 40. It is a very powerful argument. And then there's another quote that Frank refers to that is included. About the devastating loss of memory always caused by electroshock. And this is by Linda Andre, who was in Canada to promote her new book, her first book, I believe, which is Dynamite, titled Doctors of Deception, What They Don't Want You to Know About Shock Treatment. And here's what Frank has included in his letter. The most immediate, and this is actually a quote from Linda. The memory loss that happens with shock treatment is really memory erasure. A period of time is wiped out as if it never happened. Unlike memory loss associated with other conditions such as Alzheimer's, which come on gradually and allow patients and families to anticipate and prepare for the loss to some extent, the amnesia associated with ECT is sudden, violent, and unexpected. Your life is essentially unlived. You didn't just lose your suitcase. You can't say where you put it, what it looks like, what you packed in it, what trips you've taken on it. You don't know that you ever had it. Close quote. Here's another quote from a researcher, a psychologist by the name of Harold Sackheim, who's been promoting this brain damaging procedure as safe for probably over 20 or 25 years. In 2007, in this retrospective study, Sackheim reverses himself, where he mentions this study, where he says, according to Frank, This study provides the first evidence in a large prospective sample that adverse cognitive effects is a sanitized term, a euphemism for brain damage, friends. A large prospective sample that adverse cognitive effects can persist for an extended period, and that they characterize routine treatment with ECT in community settings. That was in 2007. And I'll just read one or two more because of time limitations here from Leonard Frank's piece, letter to the FDA. He refers to many deaths from shock. Electroshock causes a significant number of deaths. A 1995 report from the Texas Mental Health Department revealed that there were 8 deaths among approximately 1,600 patients, that's 1 in 200 cases, who had undergone ECT in Texas over a then recent 15-month period, a rate 50 times higher than the death rate given in the consent form sample in the American Psychiatric Association. Anyway, I will end it here by saying that Leonard Frank, along with many others, is, and that includes the Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault, CAPA, which I am a proud member, has been advocating a ban for quite a while. And he ends it here, Leonard Frank, by saying the FDA should do everything in its power to discourage the use of electroshock by keeping ECT's Class 3 high-risk rating, insisting that electroshock psychiatrists, manufacturers of ECT devices, and executives and administrators in hospitals where ECT is administered substantiate with scientific proof their claim that the procedure is safe and effective, and calling upon the Congress and Department of Justice to investigate the fraudulent and coercive use of this cruel and inhuman procedure. Friends, I thank Leonard Frank, Leonard, if you're listening, and other advocates to not be silent. Send in your letter, it may be too late, but we'll see. You can, if you really want to send a letter in, please give me a call, 416-545-0796. Now, just a quick note there. As you know, there was a outstanding fundraiser some of us held for the Psych Out conference, conference to organize resistance against psychiatry coming up in May of this year. And I want to say special thanks to others on the organizing committee, Mel Starkman, Moran McMillman, and Ilona Abramovich, for your outstanding work. It was a huge success last Friday. At the Trinity St. Paul Church, and many thanks for coming out, friends, and supporting this. All the money we take in is going to help the committee is going to go to essential expenses of the conference. Now, if you want more information on Psych Out, just Google Psych Out on your computer, PSYCHOUT, or you can, type in... it's http://ocs.library.utoronto.ca. Anyway, just type in Psych Out, and that should be enough. And then you'll see the home page. And I'm signing off for now, friends, and I should be back. I think there's a good chance in 2 weeks from now. It is in February. Do not forget to tune in to many good programs on Black History Month, which is February. And we'll keep you posted. And I hope to see you, hope to be talking with you again in 2 weeks from today. Stay well and keep feeding, keep struggling for human rights, for your rights, and the rights of all our brothers and sisters. Thank you. See you soon.
Again, she said, I've wasted too much time here, dear, as the clock ticks slowly next to my softly swaying head. And she had, but I'd wasted more. Her anger was too quiet for her to hear it, so she smiled, made a cup of tea, opened the newspaper, pretended to read. I hung over the bunk bed like from a precipice, the moment of decision broken glass on my tongue. Her mascara was running again, black serpents coiling around her breasts, the only mark of her pain. My tears always ran clear. Poised to jump or speak from my mattress mountain, I studied the lines of her face and couldn't move. She never glanced upward. It seemed to hurt her neck to watch anything in flight. That's why I started climbing. I could study her better, undetected, as she sat unmoving for years, IKEA catalog open on her lap. I'd hang by my toes from the chandelier, awaiting the moment she'd decide, again, to leave. Her eyes would flutter into focus as she remembered her feet. Then I would turn on the radio and distract her with always the same song. One day I reached so high, she became a speck far below. Toes propped up on a cloud, I allowed my mind to wander elsewhere. But the birds would have their way, forcing flight into my thoughts, their wings flapping like the pages of her catalog. Descent seemed an impossibility, my muscles unable to go downwards. So I invested in binoculars and loved her from afar.
I'm Winona LaDuke. This is CKLN 88.1.